And we're happy to spend a little time right now with Michelle Lipkin, who's with the National Association for Media Literacy Education. Michelle, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's kind of advantageous to have you on the day after an election because I can immediately ask, were we any more media literate this election cycle than the last couple?
That's an excellent question to put me on the spot. Why don't you? I do have to say what I'm seeing is really encouraging. You know, the 2016 election results, took a lot of people by surprise. But I think what happened in terms of the media literacy space is that it really got us thinking about information flow, right? It got us thinking about misinformation, about where the information we were consuming was coming from. It taught, you know, we talked about filter bubbles and echo chambers and all of these things that are really, really important. So what I see in this election and what we saw leading up to this election was a lot more critical thinking about the messages we were receiving. And we're asking the right questions. I think prior to 2016, media literacy was really something that scholars and educators were talking about. And now we're talking about it in terms of kind of the general population. And to me, that's really encouraging and really significant because these issues with how we understand information, how we assess information is important from the moment we start consuming information in media till our death, right? So we really need to be better consumers and creators of media. And so I'm encouraged. But I am an optimist.
That's nice. We need some optimism today and all days. Where do you think we went wrong, or did we go wrong, maybe is a better question. Let me frame that a little bit. I'd never really had the impression that a large segment of the population didn't really know how to consume the news, if that's a proper way to put it. I didn't understand that a lot of people were so easily deceived. I didn't listen to P.T. Barnum, I guess, at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
And this sort of came over us like, you know, oh, really? You've been relying on Facebook for most of your news content in your life? Those kind of surprises to us. Is that a new development? Is that a result of the rise of social media and the decline of, you know, big media entities that we used to focus on? Or is there something more to it than that?
Well, I think there's a couple of things at play. One is the fact that our communication systems have changed so fast over the last 5 to 10 years, right? So it's the speed of information and the amount of information is so different than it was a decade ago. And so in some ways, you know, I think we have to cut ourselves some slack and cut people some slack in if we weren't teaching people how to assess information, why would we think that they would be able to in these new systems, right? You know, why, if we're not teaching students how to assess their Twitter feeds or Facebook feeds or Instagram feeds, why do we think that they're just going to be able to do that? It's almost like assuming people will just figure out how to read on their own, right? Mm-hmm. We have to think about understanding media the same way that we think about traditional literacy and think about how much time we put into classrooms and students' education around literacy. So the speed of information and the amount of information has so drastically changed that we haven't been able to keep up. I do also think that the way that if you just think about Facebook for a second, if you think about Twitter for a second, it is very hard to discern different types of information because in a lot of ways, all the different information looks the same. So I know that I tell my students all the time that when you're looking at your Facebook feed, an article from the Washington Post and a blog from your well-meaning aunt actually appears to look kind of the same, right? And that we have to dig deeper in that. And so I do think that there's a lot of changes that we just haven't been able to keep up with, but I don't know how we would have. You know, these changes have been so rapid, and the influence that information has had on things like politics is so different than it was, 20 years ago. The other thing is we've really seen a shift in how we interact with media. We are now living in a participatory culture, right? So we are no longer living in a top-down media system or a top-down communication system. We are now involved in the system. We are participating and engaging in the system. And that is a really, really big shift. And I'm confident that we have not figured out exactly how to do that well, and that we need to give ourselves a little bit more time to kind of figure out the consequence of this participatory culture, the benefits, the, you know, the downsides of it. And we really need to be, you know, focused on moving forward and taking what we've learned simply in the last few years with information and misinformation spread and move it forward so that we can be educated in how we process and share information.
Does it seem that it's important in terms of being media literate, to understand if the organization or person that you're following that's feeding you what you perceive to be news, knowing who they are and what they're about, is that significant in the same way that you would want to know who owns the New York Times or who owns the San Francisco Chronicle and whether or not their personal opinions are driving what's being covered in those publications?
Oh, absolutely. It's a great question, and it is really important. We have some key questions as media literacy educators that we hope people are asking. And one of the first one is always, who made this message? Why was it made? And who paid for it, right? It's really important to understand the source of that information. And certainly when you're on sites that don't give you information about the source, the authors, they don't give you authors' names, that is something that we should be skeptical about. You know, we really want to understand the source of the information. That's one of the reasons that I kind of hate the phrase, you know, people get their news from social media, because they actually don't. You know, social media curates our news. We have to look beyond our Facebook feed. We can't say Facebook told me this. It's usually some other source that's been posting on Facebook. And that's a really important distinction. We have to look at these social media sites as curators, right? And that the news is actually coming from other sources. And we need to really be able to kind of track where the origin of the information is, whether it is a blog post or it is a major, you know, news publication. So it's a really important question that you're asking. And we do really have to always think about the author.
Yeah. You know, it just struck me that if we all approached analyzing bits of news information the way we would a rumor, if you called me up and told me, hey, did you hear that John lost his job? You know, the first thing I might want to ask you then is, who told you that?
Yes.
Where did you find that out? We're much more on track, I think, in that sense, in a sort of a everyday human behavior situation than we are in dealing with. Maybe it's because it's things we don't understand as well when it's part of the news. Does that make sense?
I also think it's interesting today, being, you know, post-election day, you know, really looking at my Twitter feed and noticing how many people are quoting facts and stats and data about yesterday's election without telling us what the source of that information is,
mm-hmm.
right? And I'm not saying that they're lying. It's very possible that they got that information from a reputable source. But I know for myself, I don't retweet that information. Like, unless you tell me the source
exactly.
of your data and the source of your statistics, I'm not going to share it because I can't guarantee that you're getting it from a reputable source. So I think we do have to be really careful about, you know, what we're sharing, what we're retweeting, and making sure we understand kind of where that information comes from and is it supported by facts from a reputable source.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that kind of answers the question, but
yeah.
I've been thinking about that a lot today because
mm-hmm.
there's so much activity right now on social media about the elections, which is really, I think, very interesting. And I believe it's a really exciting time to be alive, and the fact that we can all be having kind of, you know, moment to moment conversation about what we're seeing It's just that we have to be really careful about also like how we share that information, not only in on social media feeds, but just in regular conversation.
We're talking here with Michelle Lipkin, who's the executive director of the National Association for Media Literacy Education. Is there an actual curriculum? Is there an actual program that brings media literacy education to schools or to, you know, the general public in some fashion?
So there is actually an incredible amount of media literacy education happening in the U.S. right now. It is not by any means something that is required, which is, you know, kind of a problem, right? We really want our students to graduate from high school and college with a degree of knowledge in media literacy to prepare them for the world they're going to be working in and leading one day. The work that's being done within our community, so we're kind of the umbrella organization, and this week is actually U.S. Media Literacy Week, and if you have any interest in kind of learning more about what curriculum exists, what organizations are doing the best work, you can actually go hashtag MediaLitWK, and you won't believe the activity and the resources and the events that are happening this week in terms of media literacy education. But there's a lot of really, really good work being done in classrooms. It still depends on that passionate teacher, the passionate school leader, to bring the programs and the curriculum into the classroom. So we really need to see these kind of teaching practices and media literacy education scale around the country. But we are seeing incredible resources developed. When I think about the conversation regarding fake news or misinformation, I think of organizations like the Newseum or the News Literacy Project, the Center for News Literacy, organizations that have amazing tools for teachers. The Stanford History Education Group is doing a whole new curriculum on online civic reasoning. So really good stuff being out there. Our issue is we really need, public support and the general population to say that this is needed and this is vital to education today. There are incredible teachers. Yesterday I was at a workshop with librarians and then a workshop with teachers learning about media literacy. So there's a lot of interest in bringing this to the classroom. We just really need the support and the resources to get it to students.
Hmm. So how can folks listening right now find out more about your organization and how they can gain from it?
So we are at www.namely.net, and that's N-A-M-L-E. You can also go to medialiteracyweek.us. We have 250 partners around the country working on Media Literacy Week this year. We are also partnering with our Canadian neighbors. They have been doing Media Literacy Week for over a decade. So there's a lot of activity right now. So go to our website. Our membership is actually free for individuals. So you can be part of our community and part of the push for media literacy education for free. So I would say sign up to be a member. We share a lot of great information, a lot of tools, a lot of opportunities for learning through our email blast and then on our social media, and all that information you can find on namely.net.
Is National Literacy, Media Literacy Week, has that already taken place or is it coming up?
It's right now. You are in the middle of it. You are right on the, you are trending right now. It's
how
Monday
exciting.
Through Friday this week. So
fabulous.
You got me in the, right in the middle of it. So it's a really exciting week and really proud of all the efforts by all the educators around the country.
That's excellent. This is really important work. And again, that website, NAMLE, which stands for National, what does it stand for?
National Association for Media Literacy Education.
There we go. I don't know why I even tried that. I should have just thrown that to you.
I actually appreciate that.
Michelle Lipkin has been our guest here. Thank you for your time. Keep up the good work. I hope to talk to you again soon.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Enjoy your day.
You too. Bye-bye now. All right. That gets us to 7:53 here on our Wednesday KVON Morning Show. If you've been tuned in wondering when I'm going to give you the election results, well, that's coming up in just a moment. We'll run through what we know on the local scene again, give you the numbers, and touch on a few other election stories as well. A little bit later here, in a bit after the 8 o'clock break, we'll be talking about Leadership Napa Valley's board pick event. What is that about? How can you be part of it? We'll tell you. Stay tuned. That's coming up. First, all these messages.
Californians, we know that an earthquake can strike at any time. Having a plan on what to do when the shaking starts is vital. The only thing better would be to also receive an alert that the shaking is coming. Earthquake experts and public safety officials in California are developing an earthquake early warning system. Even a few seconds of notice could allow you to take action. For more information on the future of earthquake early warning, go to calalerts.org. Sponsored by the California Governor's Office of Emergency Services, aired by the California Broadcasters.
The A&W in St. Helena is now serving fresh baked blueberry and cranberry orange scones for breakfast. Or try a signature buttermilk biscuit with sausage gravy or a half-pound breakfast burrito with a variety of hot or iced coffee drinks. Breakfast is served hot, fast, and fresh Monday through Friday, 6 to 11 a.m. and on Saturday and Sunday, 7 to 11 a.m. Stop by for a delicious quick breakfast only available at your local A&W in St. Helena.
Prices may vary. Tax extra.
For 25 years, the Polyclass Foundation has been helping families to find their missing children. Open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, we are always here for families in need. Hi, it's Rainey Howe. The Polyclass Foundation has helped to bring over 10,000 missing children home safely. We've distributed over 250,000 child safety kits and have provided social media safety education to thousands of local students. We helped implement the Amber Alert in all 50 states and continue to advocate for legislation that keeps kids safe. For 25 years, the Polyclass Foundation has provided free programs and services to help keep kids safe and bring missing children home. And we could not have done it without your support. If you have a vehicle you no longer need, please give us a call. We make donating easy and you'll receive the maximum tax deduction. Call the Polyclass Foundation today at 707-769-1334 or go to polyclass.org. Thanks for your support.
And we are back at 7:55. I want to take a second to thank our election night special coverage sponsors, Alcar Human Resources, American Ag Credit, Fair Housing Napa Valley, and Matthews Mattress. Brought you the 2 hours of programming we delivered last night from 8 to 10. Thanks also to Larry Kamer, who sat in with me here in the studio. He was an excellent analyst. Larry's overqualified for the job. It was a real pleasure to work with Larry last night. Also, thanks to Jamie Brown Miller, who was out covering things, had her running all around downtown from City Hall over to the candidate parties and back again. And also Will Marcencia, tracking people down for us during the coverage last night. It was a good team effort. I'm happy about it. I'm glad we did it. I hope it was of value. For the election results this morning, let's run through the numbers again. I know people tune in at different times, and you're really wanting to hear one or two specific things, and I just keep rattling on about other stuff. So let's get into, first of all, the big ticket item in this election was the Napa City Council race. With two open seats, six candidates went at it for more than a year, as you well know. And when it's all said and done, it certainly appears that the two top vote-getters will be Liz Alessio and Mary Louros. After about a third, close to 30%, I should say, of votes are tallied, Liz Alessio has 32% of the vote, Mary Louros with 25%. And then there's a pretty big gap down to the third-place spot, Pete Mott, the incumbent in the race. And you'd have to consider that a little bit of a surprise for an incumbent to get unseated in a city council race is not impossible, but it's fairly rare. The difference being in this particular case, a lot of observers didn't feel that Pete Mott was running a very aggressive campaign this time, that perhaps he was lacking in the energy that others were putting into the race. And so maybe it's a surprise, maybe it's not, that he did not show as well as he has in previous election efforts. In fourth place, Bernie Narvaez with about 12% of the vote, and Ricky Hurtado with about 11%, and then James Hinton a little under 6%. So Alessio and Loros expected to advance to the Napa City Council. The other high-profile races in the local area were the Napa Valley College trustee races. Got to be the first time in Napa history that there was this much attention or money spent on college trustee races. In the closest of the three, Jeff Dodd has a 52-vote lead over Amy Martinson, 51.2% to 48.8%, and that's with about 25% of the vote counted. So that one's clearly too close to call, and it'll be quite some time before we know the outcome of Trustee Area 2. In Trustee Area 3, a surprise in the 18% of the vote that's counted so far, Beth Goff with a big lead over Marianne Mancuso, 61.2% to 38.8%. That, again, is with 18% of the vote counted in Trustee Area 3 for Napa Valley College. Trustee Area 4, safe to call in favor of Kyle Iverson, the incumbent, with 30% of the vote counted. Iverson with 68.6% and Julio Soriano with 31.4%. And that appears to be probably the only one of the three you can really say won't change. There's not enough vote in Area 3 to say the same, and the Area 2 vote is too close for any kind of decision at this point. In American Canyon, Mark Joseph and David Oro, the top two vote-getters in a vote-for-two scenario. However, Pierre Washington is just a few votes, seven votes, in fact, behind David Oro, so he is in third place, and that's only 18% of the vote in the American Canyon City Council race, so it's too close to call. I think you can safely say Mark Joseph will retain his seat, but who has the second seat in that race is yet to be determined. In St. Helena, the mayor's race is also too close to call, and once again, it will be quite a while before we know the final outcome there. The incumbent in that race, Mr. Galbraith, with 539 votes to challenger Jeff Ellsworth's 523 votes, a 16-vote margin separating them with about 1,000 votes counted, and that's 32.5%. of what they expect to have total, so clearly too soon to call the St. Helena mayor's race. So there you have it on the big ticket items around Napa County. The measures to raise the transient occupancy tax also deserve some attention. We'll get to that a little bit later. I'll give you the numbers as they are. These are, of course, partials and not finalized. For the most part, it appears the increase in the TOT will pass in most municipalities, but perhaps not in all, and we'll tell you more about that in just a while. That brings us to 8:01 here at KVON.